If you come down with COVID at work, is your boss responsible? Good morning. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, what the law says about contracting COVID-19 on the job. Give us a call with your questions. It's 549-2937 to join us. Then later, we're so excited to unveil our 2020 local holiday gift guide today. We'll tell you about it. But first this hour, the latest on the pandemic around Florida. The state added more than 8,500 newly confirmed infections Tuesday. That brings total caseload in the state to over 953,000 people. Cases are climbing in Duval County, too. Hundreds of new cases reported Tuesday alone. And the death toll is rising in Northeast Florida as well. One day before millions are expected to travel for Thanksgiving, despite the advice of public health experts. So we'll say it once again. Stay home on Thanksgiving. Don't have a big gathering. Keep your guard up. We are not out of the woods yet with this virus. And the virus leads this segment as we continue on now. We want to tell you about an important story. The family of a Publix employee who died after contracting coronavirus at work is now suing the Florida company. Back in March, as the virus was first spreading across the country, 70-year-old Publix deli worker Gerardo Gutierrez asked his employer, Publix, whether he could wear a face covering at his South Beach store. But he was denied, his complaint says, his family's complaint. Gutierrez died a month later in April of coronavirus. By then, the grocery chain had started requiring employees to wear masks, but it was too late for him. Now, Publix hasn't commented on this lawsuit, but employment attorneys have a lot to say about this issue. What are an employer's responsibilities to their staff in a time of pandemic? Tyler White is an employment attorney and principal at Jackson Lewis, and he's on the line. Tyler, good to talk to you once again. Good morning.
Good to talk to you, Melissa. Thanks for having me.
And here's our question to callers. What is the scope of your employer's responsibilities to your health and safety in this time of pandemic? What are your questions for employment attorney Tyler White of Jackson Lewis? Call us up now, 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org, tweets to @MelissaInJax, and our Facebook page is open too. We did reach out to Publix for comment on this wrongful death lawsuit. No response from them. And Tyler, I know you can't comment too much on the specifics of the lawsuit, but basically we're going to see more of this. The family of Mr. Gutierrez said Publix willfully prevented him from protecting himself back in March when he tried to wear a mask at work because he was coming into contact with the public. Publix said no. Is Publix liable here? What do you think the ruling might end up being?
Well, I don't represent Publix, but I can tell you what the standard is, and I think most people can make their own deductions for where this might go. And I will start out by saying that a similar lawsuit, though it wasn't a death case, it was a COVID case, was brought in New York and in a federal court, and this month it was dismissed, finding that workers' compensation was the exclusive remedy for any liability whatsoever in that state by an employee against his or her employer for injuries sustained in the course of employment. And death would also follow from that. And first of all, let me say it's a tragic thing, and my condolences go out to Mr. Gutierrez's family and everyone who's been affected by this this terrible virus. But essentially, Florida is a little bit like New York, believe it or not, in that Florida's workers' compensation law provides, in most instances, and I'll tell you about an exception, which is how this lawsuit is essentially being alleged, but in most instances, workers' compensation is the exclusive remedy for any kind of injury on the job, and that includes death. And that means injured employees and the families of workers that unfortunately may be killed in work-related accidents are typically prohibited by statute from suing their employers for those accidents suffered while on the job. Really, the only option is to file a workers' compensation claim, and usually that's true even if the employer's conduct caused the injury. Now, the exception to that rule, which I believe is kind of how we arrived at this lawsuit, is if the, of course, if the employer doesn't have workers' comp insurance, which is an unusual situation. But the real exception here is if the employer's negligent conduct is considered intentional, then workers' compensation is not the exclusive remedy. So it's really difficult to prove the employee or the employee's family, I guess in this case, must show that the employer either deliberately intended to injure the person or, and this is key, engaged in conduct the employer explicitly knew, based on warnings, was virtually certain to cause a person's injury or death.
Okay.
And so,
it seems like a high bar to prove. Tyler, if you could get off speakerphone, that would be helpful. I think you are on speaker right there. It's 549-2937 to join the show as we talk about a wrongful death lawsuit against Publix. You know, when you go into Publix or any grocery store these days, you have to wear a mask. Well, back in the early days of the pandemic, let's go back 8 months, we should note that Publix was resistant to mask wearing. We did a story in March with a Publix worker here in Jacksonville who went on the air with us and said, I've asked repeatedly if I can wear a mask and I've been told no, I don't feel safe at work. A week or so after that, Publix changed their policy on masks. I think public pressure did make somewhat of a difference, and other retailers quickly followed suit. And as we talk about this case of Mr. Gutierrez in South Florida, he was asking to wear a mask at about the same time, early mid-March. He got sick. He died. He was 70 years old, working in a Publix deli. Corporate leadership decided to mandate mask wearing chain-wide in April. It was too late for him. And as we talk about what Tyler is saying is a very high bar for proving gross negligence on the part of an employer, we want your questions. It's 549-2937. And Tyler, let me follow up and explain or have you explain that this whole issue of workplace liability is what is holding up COVID relief legislation in Congress. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell says he wants a five-year liability shield to be a key demand in negotiations for the next sort of stimulus that the American people could be getting out of the government, basically saying that businesses need wide-ranging protections from civil liability for harm, including deaths, that their actions may or may not have caused in this pandemic. And so There are a lot of legal niceties to this, but this is also a big political football right now. We are being held up as Americans from relief for the millions that are unemployed out there because Congress is arguing over how protected employers should be. What are your thoughts about this as an employment attorney?
Well, I think obviously anytime relief to people who need it is held up, it's very unfortunate to say the least. But I think the key to these type of lawsuits, and you know, going back to what you were originally talking about with respect to the timing of this particular incident, I think the key is going to be what did the employer know about the virus and when did it know it? So, for example, what steps was the employer taking to protect its employees at the time? And, you know, I did a little backwards research here in preparation for today, and actually it looks like the CDC made the recommendation that citizens should wear non-medical cloth masks when it is essential in public places on April 3rd. And that recommendation may be something that's key to these type of lawsuits. For example, if that recommendation came out on April 3rd and employers, you know, after that point were refusing to, you know, allow their employees to wear masks, and I must make note, I don't know if that's actually the case with Publix. I understand the allegation. But in any case, I think that's a little bit of a different issue because then ignoring the actual guidance, the medical guidance, that had come out. Because remember, there was some confusion early on, and perhaps that's the reason for the holdup on the legislation, is that the confusion early on about the virus and how you protect employees from the virus could result in liability for employers. But I agree with you. Certainly, at the end of the day, people need relief and they need mm-hmm. to get it.
Yeah, it is unfortunate that this is happening. And so how closely do you think this Publix lawsuit will be watched? It is getting national publicity. It seems to be something of a flashpoint already.
It is. I mean, I think that a lot of these lawsuits are being examined. Another one was filed in California, and I'm not sure of the status of that one right now. But so these are being filed right now. And in states like Florida, where you have the workers' compensation as the exclusive remedy, my opinion is a lot of these lawsuits from at least the early phases of the virus, so for example, pre-April 3rd, let's use that, those are going to have a hard time showing that the employer knew that not allowing a mask, for example, was virtually certain to cause death or injury. And I think those lawsuits are going to have some difficulties and some hurdles to face even getting in front of a jury, because they may be dismissed at a very early stage.
It's also, I would think it would be very difficult to prove where you got the virus.
That is a part of it, although I think in some cases, for example, if you work next to someone who tested positive, and then you can show you tested positive only days later. It's not that there would be a presumption, but, from a workers' compensation standpoint, it may be that an insurer would accept that, but it really just depends on the workers' compensation carrier.
It's 549-2937 as we speak with employment attorney Tyler Wyatt. He's principal at the Jackson Lewis firm. Are you worried about getting COVID at your job? What are your questions about this? 549-2937. Meanwhile, lots of tweets and emails. Here's one from Kelsey Tyler. She says, my mother is a nurse and was recently diagnosed with COVID-19. She believes she and other nurses were exposed because the hospital she works for and the doctor she works under refused to test all of the incoming patients. They've mandated that she come back to work and told her she will be working with the other positive nurses and patients. My question is, can the hospital and the doctor be held liable if she becomes hospitalized or, God forbid, dies?
Good question. And, I think the same principle applies. In a healthcare setting, workers' compensation is a remedy for both injury and death as far as liability goes. And the question becomes, for example, OSHA's standpoint, nurses are considered their highest level of potential exposure risk. And so the question becomes not just what did the hospital know and when did it know it, but can it articulate all of the things that it's doing and all of the steps it's taking to protect its staff? For example, respirators. Is it doing everything it can to conduct the fit tests, the medical evaluations for respirators? Because respirators are a little bit different than just the cloth face covering. When I say respirator, I also mean the N95 mask that we've heard so much about, because that protects the wearer and not just, protects others. Mm-hmm. So, those are important PPE that have to be in place, particularly for healthcare workers.
Karen emails the show, is there a form for patients and visitors to sign a waiver to prevent lawsuits? If a person was to say, I contracted COVID when I was inside your building, how do you see companies protecting themselves from the public coming into their space and then saying, I think I got this disease on your property?
Well, to Karen's question of, is there a form? I'm willing to bet if any of you have had to go out in the midst of this pandemic and maybe get your hair cut or something else, you may have signed a form that tries to waive liability. there's a question as to whether or not those waivers of liability are going to be enforceable. And I think that is going to be something that's up in the air and certainly something that we can expect more lawsuits on. Maybe I'll see you in, you know, a month or two whenever those hit.
Yeah. What's the most common question you're getting about this as an employment attorney? You must be getting hammered right now with these kinds of questions.
Well, the real issue for employers is when one of their employees tests positive, what do we do? And, you know, the biggest thing is to understand who that employee came into contact with and who the secondary contacts of that person was, you know, came into contact with, and essentially put those people out of work, you know, for 10 to 14 days, make sure that they have a negative test and, you know, that they're taking care of their employees in that way, because it's really all about the spread at this point. It is a deadly disease, but even, you know, more significant about the virus, rather, is the fact that it spreads so easily.
Yeah, exactly right. Lots of tweets coming in for Tyler White of Jackson Lewis. Here's one from Jim. Remember back in April? And he links to a story that published in April. Former OSHA officials voice alarm as Trump tells corporations they don't have to record coronavirus cases among their workers. As you mentioned, Tyler, in the early days of the pandemic, it was a fast-moving, fluid situation. People were scrambling to figure out what to do. We do have somewhat of the benefit of hindsight now, but that said, can people make the argument in court that officials knowingly were being negligent based on the information they had at the time? I think that's the existential question here.
So I suppose part of the question is, could a case be made that employers knew the risks despite certain officials saying there wasn't a risk or there was a low risk and they ignored it anyway? I think the official guidance is what's going to probably rule the day here. I mean, I think the CDC guidance at a given time and, of course, the OSHA workplace guidance, those are the two types of things that I think are going to be examined historically when looking at the effects of this on the workplace.
All right, let's go to some calls now for employment attorney Tyler White of Jackson Lewis. What are your questions about liability in the workplace when it comes to this pandemic, contracting COVID on the job? 549-2937 to join us. Tim is in Orange Park. Hi, Tim. Good morning.
Good morning. Yeah, I sold my martial arts school out in Great Coast Springs in, I believe it was April. But we have other schools that are still open around the area. And everybody's doing 6 to 10 feet, and there's no contact, which is weird for martial arts. But they're doing a 6 to 10 feet where you're all using, everybody's using protection, facial protection. But if somebody, if one of the students gets the virus, who's responsible? And I'll take my answer.
Sure. Thanks, Tim. Thank you for that. Tyler.
Sure. So when it comes to school risk, the OSHA category for that is a medium exposure risk. I mean, and this also, OSHA also categorized a medium exposure risk for retail workers, grocery stores, you know, things like that. And as far as liability goes, again, it comes down to, how much is the school doing, you know, to protect its workers, and not just a written policy, right? It's not just having some written policy. It's, are they really enforcing what their policy says with respect to distancing and with respect to mask wearing and appropriate mask wearing? I mean, is the mask still exposing the nose? Are they being lax about students and teachers? And then I think, again, as far as the liability goes, it comes down to, is the school receiving complaints? You know, I think that'd be part of the discovery process of a lawsuit. And what did the school do in response to those complaints? Did they investigate the fact that an entire class was allowed not to wear masks for one period or something like that. You know, and if they didn't, then does that look more intentional? I mean, I think that's the question.
Yeah. And, you know, given that there's really no national strategy, no comprehensive uniform approach to this, states have thrown up a patchwork of approaches and rules to combat this virus. It really does seem in some sense, Tyler, that we are at the mercy of our employer in many respects. I mean, for me and my colleagues at WJCT, we feel very fortunate in that beginning in March, protocols were put into place here in our building. Masks were mandatory from the beginning, way before the city did a mask mandate. No outside guests are allowed in the building. We have a waiver for people to sign if they want to come into the building. We only have core staff here. It's been that way for 8 months now. And so consequently, we feel really safe in our workplace. We feel as though we're not at risk. That can't be said for millions of workers out there, particularly frontline workers, retail workers, police, fire, teachers, hospital staff. They just don't have the same workplace situation. And so coming out of this whole nightmare, do you think we might see some changes in workplace regulations that deal with this kind of situation? What do you think will come out of this in the end?
Well, I tell you, with the transition to a new administration always comes changes. However, if you look at what President-elect Biden has said he's going to do in his first 100 days, not only is it probably incredibly ambitious, I don't know if he'll be able to accomplish it all in 100 days. And I don't see anything that he's proposing right now as far as a particular workplace safety related protection. However, he is expected to support paid leave benefits for employees, which I think is important, including expansion of the paid sick days and leave provisions of the Families First Coronavirus Response Act that was passed earlier this year. The other thing that I know he supports is 12 weeks of paid leave for all workers, you know, to care for newborns and a person's own or family member's serious health condition, or to care for injured service members. That's going to be a significant difference from what we have now, which is the Family Medical Leave Act, which allows for unpaid leave. Because as you said earlier, the issue is how do people get relief if they're not, earning wages?
Mark tweets the show, "I believe employers have a responsibility to do everything they can to make workplaces safe. That said, good luck proving causation here." He's referring to the Publix lawsuit. Here's another tweet. "Businesses, especially large ones, really missed an opportunity to mitigate the spread of the virus through their employees. They should have been testing on a regular basis any location that has over 50 employees and used part of the PPP funds to do it." Daniel tweets the show, "Publix should pay out handsomely and face criminal prosecution for not following safety protocols. The amount of mask enforcement they refused to do in the beginning is pathetic. Anytime you shop there now, many other stores too, it's a risk and it's not being mitigated because they don't want to enforce mask wearing." That begs another question, Tyler. We do have a mask mandate in Duval County. Lots of other cities around the state have one, but they really don't have any enforcement mechanism. That's because the governor has told municipalities they can't really enforce a mask mandate. What do you think about that?
Well, I think you're right. I mean, it's a mask mandate, but at the end of the day, isn't it really just a mask recommendation?
Yeah.
You know, without enforcement, what is a mandate? And I think, you know, to a lot of folks' point about wanting to feel safe, you know, as a customer of these places, I think if you do see other customers not wearing masks, and, you know, I think you need to voice your opinion to these retailers that you believe that they should really try to enforce mask wearing for the safety of others, because that's what mask wearing is for. It's not, mask wearing is not for the user, it's for the safety of everyone else.
We're getting emails about that art on the East Side. Emails the show, I am boycotting Publix. Numerous times I've seen customers there without masks, and most commonly in the deli line, which is where the employee died. Several times last week, I saw a worker pull down her mask and got close to customers in conversation. Boycott Publix, he says. All right, let's go to John on the South Side. Hi, John. Go ahead.
How you doing, Miss Melissa, this morning?
Good morning.
I have noticed at all the supermarkets, especially Walmart, especially Publix, where they don't enforce. Now, they say they do, but they do not enforce it. And so it has put a lot of the essential workers that keep this country and kept this country going through the COVID and put their life in danger. Now, we know in May, the Democratic House tried to pass a stimulus bill with protections in that and a little spill for the endangerment of the essential workers' lives. And then all of a sudden, it's not big business, it's not banks, it's not all these big people. And then all of a sudden, the Republican Senate block it. And we still sitting here after an election with over 250,000 people dead, unemployment bad, and these people still ain't did nothing. And the bill been sitting there since May. It is a travesty, and it's just appalling. And I'm going to tell you, when Bush was president, he told the workers, people, they didn't have to pay unemployment. After his didn't have to pay overtime. After his administration, all them businesses were sued and lost. All right. Thank you, Mr.
All right. Thank you. All right, Tyler, Workers' Bill of Rights. And he referenced the holdup in Congress that's been going on for most of the year on another round of relief funds for people out there who are struggling. That, I think that is causing a lot of anger out there.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it's understandable. I mean, I think that, you know, to have businesses shut down for as long as they were and to, you know, now have a tangible effect on those places as well, and to affect the safety of the workers, I think people need relief.
Well, let's hope they get it soon. And I want to thank you for your thoughts. It's such a timely and serious topic for so many out there who are at risk of contracting COVID at work. He's Tyler White, employment attorney and principal at Jackson Lewis, the firm here in Jacksonville. Tyler, have a great Thanksgiving, and thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks. Same to you, Melissa.
All right, much more still ahead after a short break. Later, much excitement as we unveil our second annual 2020 local holiday gift guide with ideas for everyone on your list. That's later, but up next.
I've been looking at that statue since I was 5 years old, and it is definitely one of the most gorgeous outdoor works of art in Jacksonville, if not in Florida.
It's the story of a sculpture, but also the history of a city. A conversation with author Wayne Wood next. We'll be right back. It's the biggest stories affecting the Sunshine State. Hi, I'm Melissa Ross.
And I'm Tom Hudson. Join us Friday for the Florida Roundup.
Each week at noon, we interview newsmakers and people from across the state discussing the stories and issues that affect your life. What's driving the conversation in Florida?
Join the conversation on the Florida Roundup.
Every Friday at noon on WJCT News 89.9. Welcome back. Well, author and historian Wayne Wood has the perfect coffee table book just out for you to snap up this holiday season. In it, he tells the story of that iconic sculpture in Riverside's Memorial Park. That sculpture is called Life. Now, it's the story of the sculptor who created it, but also a tour through this city's history with some incredible photographs and historical detail. I spoke with Wayne about life, the untold story of Charles Adrian Pillars. Take a listen. Hi, Wayne. Good to talk to you. Thanks for being with us.
Good morning, Melissa. It's good to be with you.
You are such a prolific author, so it's no surprise you're out with a landmark new book. It's exciting to talk to you about this. It's called Life, the Untold Story of Charles Adrian Pillars. And what's cool about this is that you're going to educate us about this man. He is the guy who created that gorgeous sculpture in Memorial Park in Riverside. Many of us have walked by that beautiful piece of art many times, but we didn't know the story of the man. So tell us about Pillars. Who was he?
Well, that was the question that got this book started in the beginning, in that I've been looking at that statue since I was 5 years old, and like many other people who appreciate art, it is definitely one of the most gorgeous outdoor works of art in Jacksonville, if not in Florida. It is a fabulous, iconic work of bronze sculpture. And everybody knows it. You know, it's the logo of several different organizations. It's been used many times as an image to represent Jacksonville. And yet, as fabulous as that work of sculpture is, nobody knew a darn thing about the guy that did it.
Mm-hmm.
And you start asking questions, you know, if he did something this amazing, where are all the other sculptures he did? Why don't we have one of his sculptures on every corner? If he was a Jacksonville sculptor, who was this guy? And so it took a lot of digging because there was really very little historic record about this man. Luckily, two of his daughters were still alive when I started on this book nearly 10 years ago. They've now passed away. They were in their 90s. But they had some interesting anecdotes and some stories, but they were, you know, not in their prime. And so there was a lot of murkiness about who this man was and where he came from. It turns out he came from the Midwest. He was from rural Illinois. And as a young man, he showed talent as a sculptor and went to Chicago to apprentice with one of the foremost sculptors of the day, Laredo Taft. And that just happened to coincide with the coming of the great 1893 Chicago World's Fair, which was called the World's Columbian Exposition. And this was a mecca for sculptors all over the world to come and help to build the World's Fair with the fabulous palatial buildings that made up the Great White City.
Mm-hmm.
Sculpture was everywhere. And so he got to do some of the work on some of the sculptors for the fair. But also he got to work with some of the greatest sculptors in the world. For example, Daniel Chester French, who later went on to design the Lincoln Memorial, and Edward Potter, who was one of the foremost equestrian sculptors of the day. And so it turns out that he got to sculpt the head of the giant colossus that was out in the middle of the lagoon. If any of your listeners have ever read The Devil in the White City, the book about the World's Fair, they know some of the fabulous panoramas that this World's Fair was. It changed the whole culture of America because it had so many innovations in it. So
it was a huge deal for its time, yeah.
Yeah, and so they had the coldest winter in the history of Chicago. Pillars hated the cold, so he had the idea that he would come to Florida where it was warm, and he would not only come to Florida, but he would come to the biggest city in Florida, Jacksonville, where they would be welcoming him with open arms. And he did. He came to Jacksonville, and he got here and looked around, and they said, sculpture? What would you do with that? Why would you want to have sculpture? We don't do that down here.
he was going to bring some sophistication to Jacksonville then.
But it wasn't terribly receptive to it. And so he began his many years of struggle to awaken Jacksonville to the wonders of culture. And he did get several small commissions, but he struggled throughout his life. He did do two large sculptures that were placed in the Capitol Rotunda in Washington, D.C., representing Florida, and that plus the great life sculpture that he did in the 1920s were his greatest work. But the whole appeal of this story is he was a complicated, very troubled man in so many ways, and yet he touched so many people around him during this time. This story includes the Great Fire of Jacksonville. He was in it. Hmm. It includes the World War One, the great flu epidemic of 1918, the Roaring Twenties, the Great Depression. There are so many historical events that happened in Jacksonville that he was part of, and he knew all of these great characters who became part of Jacksonville. So quickly the book became a story about what Jacksonville was really like. Who were the people? What was it like during this time from the 1890s to the 1930s when he was here?
Yeah. So we're going back in time a century and a little more to get into the impact that Pillars had on this city. But as I look at the cover of your book, it culminated, of course, with the unveiling in 1924 of the life sculpture in Memorial Park, which is an incredible work of art with the globe and then the figure of the man atop the globe. There's a lot of movement and dynamism to this bronze piece. It's so striking. What was he trying to say with this piece?
You hit the nail on the head there. It is a very striking and complicated sculpture. It was originated by the Rotary Club after World War One, the Great War, as they called it, to be a memorial for all the soldiers who died in the World War. And he had a great deal of difficulty coming up with the right image, and the story tells some of that, how, for example, Mrs. Cummer, later famous for the Cummer Museum, was very strategic in pushing his buttons to get him to do the greatest work he'd ever done. But the sculpture itself is two parts. There is a winged youth rising above a globe, and the globe on the bottom is a swirling vortex with people caught up in the swirling waves, and it's metaphorically representing the troubles of war, the chaos, the cruelty and the devastation of war in the bottom globe with all of these poor, helpless people caught up in the maelstrom. And then on top, this winged youth with a laurel wreath and an olive branch rise above the swirling chaos and give hope to light the world for the future. And in doing so, memorializes all those who died in the war. But the fact is, it's very realistic. When it was first unveiled, everyone gasped. There was a nude young
male
man,
figure,
very, very well built on top of this globe. But yet, in his realism, the globe down below is very abstract, and so it's this combination of very complex images and thoughts. And not everyone who sees it realizes it at first, but the more you study it, the more you realize it's not just a genius way of memorializing deceased soldiers and giving hope to the world, but it's an engineering marvel in that this huge 20-foot statue, the winged man is standing on one toe, balanced with his silhouette against the great St. John's River and in the beautiful Memorial Park in front of him.
So when we walk by the sculpture today, all of the themes he was hitting on, they kind of seem relevant today, 100 years later, as we try to get through this challenging time of our pandemic, the recession, and look ahead to the new, the decade that's unfurling in front of us.
We all need winged hope rising above the chaos that we're now facing to give us encouragement to go on. And so that's part of the exciting thing of writing a book, is you get to learn so much and delve into the life of a fascinating person, but in also a very fascinating time, which gives me a chance to tell hundreds of smaller stories about Jacksonville and Northeast Florida. And it's fun writing a book. You know, when it comes out, it's like birthing a baby. You've worked on it for years and years, And now the whole world gets to see the story and the things that we've discovered. There were so many curious things about this man. One of his sculptures was on a United States postage stamp. He later taught at the Ringling School of Art in Sarasota, and one of his students was the second tallest man in the world. He was a giant in the circus.
Wow. And didn't he do the sculptures of Kirby Smith and John Gorey that are displayed in Washington?
Those are in the United States Capitol, although General Kirby Smith
that's been removed
from the Capitol rotunda because he's a Confederate general.
Yeah.
But he was very famous on the world stage. And yet his life is a tragic up and down of tumult and failure and success and poverty. So it's a neat story. That was what drew me into writing a book about him, because rarely do you get a chance to write a novel-like history book to combine the two. So it's meticulously researched. There are thousands of footnotes at the end. And yet it is a story that it would be enjoyable for someone who just wanted to read a great, rollicking novel. So it's a history book. It's a story of Jacksonville. It's a story of our greatest artist and certainly our greatest work of art. The book is published by the Jacksonville Historical Society, and it goes on sale now. It's just come out. It can be purchased at the usual bookstores, Chamblin's and San Marco Bookstore, and also can be purchased online through the Jacksonville Historical Society website, www.jackshistory.org. It's $49.95, and I have to say we planned this to come out just a month before the holidays, so that it may be hopefully one of the most popular holiday gifts on your shopping list.
It's a perfect coffee table book for your friend, your neighbor, your family. We are adding it to our holiday gift guide, too. So come and check it out. Pick up your copy of Life, the Untold Story of Charles Adrian Pillars. As Wayne said, all proceeds go to the Jacksonville Historical Society. Wayne, you've done it again, and it's so good to hear your voice. Thanks so much for sharing this with us. It's really fascinating.
Thanks for having me, Melissa. It's always a pleasure.
Again, you can pick that book up at jackshistory.org or at your local bookstore. And when we come back, we've got some positive news and notes for your Wednesday, including our new holiday gift guide. That's in just a few minutes. Keep listening. We'll be right back.
Conductor Thomas Wilkins returns to Jacksonville to lead the symphony in Tchaikovsky's beautiful Serenade for Strings. Written in the model of his great idol Mozart, the Serenade for Strings is still filled with Tchaikovsky's hallmark romanticism. The images it projects are rich, deep, abstract, and enduring. The program also features Poulenc's wonderful Sinfonietta, December 4th and 5th in physically distanced Jacobi Symphony Hall. For tickets and information, visit jacksymphony.org.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This Thanksgiving is also the 50th anniversary of the National Day of Mourning, but Indigenous organizers aren't protesting your family dinner.
I have nothing wrong with people getting together with their friends and family and eating a meal together. You know, that's not the part of Thanksgiving I object to. It's the Thanksgiving mythology.
That's next time on Here and Now.
Today at 2 on WJCT News 89.9.
Black Friday is not going to be the same this year. Hard to know, though, what exactly it is going to be.
We have scaled back on like the stock just to be on the safe side. We'd rather have too little than too much.
How retailers are confronting the holiday shopping uncertainty next time on Marketplace.
Tonight at 6 here on WJCT News 89.9.
After the turkey, do you plan to watch a game or play one? This year, more are passing up the Cowboys for a queen and trading the Ravens for a rook, thanks to a nudge from Netflix.
I can control it. I can dominate it. And it's predictable.
Chess is having a moment. I'm Jen White. See the whole board next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Well, are you looking forward to some turkey, pumpkin pie, and a safe holiday gathering? We are too. After an incredibly challenging year, there is still much to be thankful for. So we're going to round up some positive news and notes from the week for your enjoyment on this Thanksgiving Eve. No gravy required to dive right in. It's our What's Good Wednesdays. And now we're going to kick it off with our salute to buying local. Yes, local. It's the season for giving. So this year, when you share gifts, try to support local businesses when you do your holiday shopping. We are here to help. We made a list, we checked it twice, and we scoured the First Coast for great ideas for everyone on your list, naughty and nice. Yes, that's right. Our 2020 local holiday gift guide is live right now at WJCT.org. You can check it out online through Christmas Day. And if you don't want to go physically shopping into stores in this pandemic, you can access virtually every one of these items online as well. So happy shopping. Thanks so much to our intern, Catherine Hobbs, who pulled together this amazing guide with a little input from Heather Schatz and myself. Thanks to Heather's husband and kids for being patient and not eating all the edible items until she took pictures of them first. Okay, other news from the week. We've got an item on our gift guide list that involves your fur babies. Yes, Animal Care and Protective Services volunteers are running a Secret Santa for adoptable pets. You can adopt a pet like you would adopt a child during the holidays, but instead of buying toys for the child, you buy treats and toys for the dog or cat in the shelter. I spoke about it with Jennifer Walter, Division Chief of Animal Care and Protective Services.
Those in the community that want to take part and be a Secret Santa can either choose a pet that they see on our website that kind of catches their eye. They can ask to be assigned a specific pet, or they can just send a gift addressed to Secret Santa, and we'll choose a pet in the shelter that hasn't received a gift yet. So COVID has changed Secret Santa a little bit. So this year, instead of doing in-person pet delivery gifts. Instead, we are videoing and taking photos of the pets unwrapping those gifts. So there's actually a Facebook page called Santa's Elves, Secret Santa to Benefit Jack's ACPS, and our elves will post videos and photos of the animals opening and playing with their gifts on there. It's a great way for the members of the community that have done the shopping for the pets to get to know the personality of the pet, and of course, fostering and adopting is always one of the positive outcomes for this type of event.
So check that out, and here's another cool item that caught our eye this week. Back in September, restaurateurs Sam and Kylie Efron of Taverna in San Marco came up with a plan to support their staff and give back to local healthcare workers. It's called Meals for Medical Workers. Every $10 they raise through a GoFundMe account provides a handcrafted meal to a Baptist Health employee and additional shifts for their staff. The local baseball league, the CBC Riverhawks, kicked in $1,400 for this. Last Saturday, they made their first drop-off of 140 meals to the hardworking frontline healthcare workers at Baptist Health. Very nice to see that. Well, do you enjoy scribbling rhymed verse in your moleskin journal? Tired of your unrecognized genius not being shared with the world? You want to contact then local charity Hope at Hand. They provide therapeutic poetry lessons for at-risk kids. They're inviting poets to submit original poems to them around the concept of convergence. Poems must be a maximum of 20 lines. You can't put in any profanity. Keep it clean, people. Just submit your poem via email to sydney@hopeathand.org by December 4th. The top five poems will be displayed in the new year. They'll be judged by the North Florida Poetry Hub. We want to give a shout out to the city of Brunswick, Georgia. They just opened a new outreach center to help homeowners impacted by Hurricane Irma. Yes, Irma. People still suffering from that. The Homeowner Rehabilitation and Reconstruction Program will offer free repairs for homeowners in the 31520 zip code in Brunswick if you still have home damage from the storm. That zip code apparently is one of Georgia's three most impacted and distressed areas, so that is much needed. And finally, some great news from here at WJCT. The Charlie Brown Christmas special will air for free on broadcast TV this year, right here on WJCT Public Television. PBS has teamed up with Apple TV to share a Charlie Brown Christmas, just like they did with a Charlie Brown Thanksgiving. Now, there was some worry that these classics might not air on broadcast TV this year because Apple did get the rights and the Halloween special didn't air in October. But the rest of the holiday tradition has been saved. So be sure to tune in Sunday night, December 13th at 7:30 p.m. on WJCT TV 1, 7.1 for a Charlie Brown Christmas. It will also air on Comcast 8 and Channel 440. PBS Kids will broadcast it on WJCT TV 7.3. Lots of places to watch. That forlorn Charlie Brown Christmas tree is part of all of our childhoods. So it's beyond great to see it on our TVs once again this season. And if you've got a tasty item you'd like us to add to our weekly menu, drop us a line and check out our What's Good Wednesdays e-newsletter online and subscribe. That's our show. Thanks for listening today, and thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Heather Schatz. Josh Torres is show director. Brady Corum is running the board today, though. Our news director is Jessica Palumbo, and Bill Bortsfield is our digital editor. And thanks to our interns this semester, Catherine Hobbs and Patrick Canton. Keep those emails coming. Send that feedback to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. I'm Melissa Ross. We'll be off tomorrow and Friday, back Monday. Have a safe and happy Thanksgiving holiday.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.